The topic announced for this lecture is the representation of saints in contemporary Indian fiction. Turns out that there isn't much interest in sadhus or yogis or gyanis or bhaktas or sants, to use some of the terms that are appropriate to my tradition, that there isn't much interest in North Indian fiction of the last 100 years in people who explored or became the farther reaches of consciousness. It turns out that the dominant concerns of writers in North India in the last 100 years, the two concerns have been, one has been social justice, you know, moving from feudalism to a more egalitarian society, which includes, of course, moving from colonization to a nation state, but even within the nation state to a more egalitarian society, including women, outcasts, tribal folk, into the institutions of representation. This is easily the dominant preoccupation in the fictional space, in the space of literary forms and cinematic forms in North Indian culture. And the other preoccupation is how to survive in the city, how to endure it, how to discover human life in it. The sense one gets in this fiction is that many people who lived on the land or near trees or rivers have been forcibly airdropped into a space of anonymity and industrial work and neighbors who don't share your microculture, and people are having to improvise with anonymity, with the strange sexual haze among strangers in the city, with the impersonality of neighborhoods and communities. This is my description of what is dominant. One of the writers from North India most celebrated for his activist fiction is a writer named Premchand, who died in 1936. Who started out as a school inspector and began to write a few stories in which people in subaltern roles to the British discover their own dignity or fumble towards some loyalty other than that to their masters. And he was hauled up for writing some of these stories and advised, in the interests of his career, not to pursue this kind of fiction. And he responded by resigning from the job and going back and trying to farm or, you know, run a printing press and never quite succeeding. In that way, a kind of Mark Twain figure. But along the way, writing like a busy telegraph operator who dashes off stories in the middle of delivering other people's messages, some of the most intense awakening activist stories in India. A man named Premchand. And another writer profoundly interested in enabling us to become the people who could change Indian society was a poet named Muktibodh, who after independence wrote poems of the disappointment and betrayal of those hopes of a more just and equal society. So looking for yogis and sadhus in such a field is, it's like looking for needles. And I found a couple of examples from us, and it turns out the examples are illustrative of the power of the cultural frame of reference that we proposed yesterday. There are more powerful indicators of the persistence of that frame of reference than if I had found many novels which were exploring the conditions of sadhus. Now, there's huge bias in the material I'm looking at, in what I consider fiction. So there is a psychoanalyst in Delhi who's just written a novel called The Ecstasy about the relationship between Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, and Paramahansa Yogananda. And to me, this is sort of reductive, neo-Freudian reading of these people. It's not fiction, which I find interesting when a diversity of points of view is allowed unresolvable life. It's a kind of fictional space in which diversity persists. So I was going to tell you about two works of fiction, one called The Guide, written originally in English by a writer named R.K. Narayan, internationally available, made into a popular and important film in India. It tells the story of a reluctant saint, a con man who, when he gets out of jail, is so embarrassed to go back to his girlfriend or to his mother that he sleeps the night out by some desolate temple, and when he wakes up in the morning, there's some grizzled peasant staring reverentially at him and saying, "Sir, I have a problem." And I was going to read you some of the ways in which this skeptical view of sainthood is rendered. So what I was reading for the dead Mike, if you recall, was, "I have a problem," said the man. "I have a problem, sir," said the man. Raju nodded his head and added, "So has everyone," in a sudden access of pontificality. And maybe if I read you a few more lines, you'll see the resonances to our inquiry. Ever since the moment this man had come and sat before him, gazing on his face, he had experienced a feeling of importance. He felt like an actor who was always expected to utter the right sentence. Now, the appropriate sentence was, "If you show me a person without a problem, then I'll show you the perfect world." "Do you know what the great Buddha said?" The other edged nearer. A woman once went wailing to the great Buddha, clasping her dead baby to her bosom. The Buddha said, "Go into every home in the city and find one where death is unknown. If you find such a place, fetch me a handful of mustard from there, and then I'll teach you how to conquer death." The man clicked his tongue in appreciation and asked, "And what happened to the dead baby, sir?" "She had to bury it, of course," said Raju. So also, he concluded, while doubting in his mind the relevance of the comparison, "If you show me a single home without a problem, I shall show you the way to attain a universal solution to all problems." So, it proceeds in this way, and this man has a problem with his daughter who doesn't want to marry the match that has been arranged for her, his own sister's son, who in their culture would be an appropriate match. And this man says, "No, let problems take their time. Let me think on it and come back to me." And apparently by the time he comes back, the girl has decided on her own that it is wise to follow the dictates of her parents. And so, there's great amplification of this saint. In the middle of the story, we find out that there's a great drought on this village, and someone miscommunicates to the villagers that the man who has been eating fat off of the offerings made to this guy who set the household right, that this man will fast until the god of rain relents and offers them rain. And what I was going to illustrate through readings was that in the middle of this skepticism, the writer allows the con man the ambiguous space in which the con man, out of empathy for the suffering of the people in the village, goes through with the fast. And the closing, beautifully ambiguous lines of the novel are, "At 5:30 in the morning, the doctors examined the Swami. They wrote and signed a bulletin saying, 'Swami's condition grave. Declines glucose and saline, should break the fast immediately, advise procedure.' They sent a man running to send off this telegram to their headquarters." By then there's a whole media crowd and there's an American reporter, and so there's also anxiety about the right image of Indian Swamihood in the international, in global space. They sat beside the Swami and read the message to him. He smiled at it. He beckoned the villager to come nearer. The doctors appealed, tell him he should save himself. Please do your best. He's very weak. The peasant bent close to the Swami and said, the doctors say. In answer, Raju, the con man. In answer, Raju asked the man to bend nearer and whispered, help me to my feet, and clung to his arm and lifted himself. He got up to his feet. He had to be held by the peasant and another one on each side. In the profoundest silence, the crowd followed him down. Everyone followed at a solemn, silent pace. The eastern sky was red. Many in the camp were still sleeping. Raju could not walk, but he insisted upon pulling himself along all the same. He panted with the effort. He went down the steps of the river, halting for breath on each step, and finally reached his basin of water. This is where he stood to pray for rain. He stepped into it, shut his eyes, and turned towards the mountain, his lips muttering the prayer which he had made up. The peasant and another held him each by an arm. The morning sun was out by now. A great shaft of light illuminated the surroundings. It was difficult to hold Raju on his feet, as he had a tendency to flop down. They held him as if he were a baby. Raju opened his eyes, looked about, and said, it's raining in the hills. I can feel it coming up under my feet, up my legs. He sagged down. And so all I was illustrating, and what I would have by more comparisons, except it's fun to go into the second story, was that even a skeptical look at the projection of Swamihood includes the possibility of somebody awakening to a sense of the pain of others on his last legs. And that ambiguity is there in the fiction. The second, which I will read to you in its entirety for reasons I think you will appreciate, is the one story on the subject of spirituality that Premchand wrote. And I was saying to some of us in the faculty when we were talking about our plans, how I would read you a story by a man who had been asked why he never wrote stories about... He wrote lots of stories about pandits and sadhus in which he exposed them mercilessly. So they asked him why he didn't write stories about spiritual people and whatever. A professor of English in 1936 wrote to him from Punjab with a list of 14 questions. So we have the questions and the answers. And question 8 or 9 was, what is your opinion about God? And Premchand's answer was, we are ants crawling on a rock in the hot sun. And really, his stories about the treatment of outcasts, in which he allows the outcasts to cadge all they can, you know, not just helpless victims, but people who understand that when they're on the margin and at people's mercies, they can invent occasions for mercies and gain some of the things they hope to possess in life. And he wrote stories about Brahmins so sharp that when a great filmmaker like Satyajit Ray, an Indian filmmaker, made a film based on one of these stories, Indian television sat on it for 2 years because Brahmins wouldn't allow the story to be televised.
What is the story?
The story is called Deliverance or Sadgati, and it's about a tanner who wants the engagement of his... So tanner is... In a rough sense of the caste system, a tanner is an outcast, you know, in contact with the leather of dead animals, lives at the edge of a village. But for certain ritual occasions, the tanner needs the blessings of the village priest. And so, the first sequence is the tanner preparing to go to the village priest and beg him to come in the afternoon and bless the forthcoming engagement of his daughter. And his wife calls out to him, you know, what are you going to offer to the pandit, to the holy man. And they have, well, he says, you know, I'm going out to pick some leaves of some medicinal tree. And the wife says, you know, make sure the plate is clean. And she says, he's not going to come anyway, because if you go to see him, he keeps you waiting all day and he tells you all kinds of things to do. But the tanner is a good man. And he tells his daughter, who's eager to help, he says, and while I go pick these leaves, you run off, and this is what we need to get for all the ritual things the priest will do when he comes to the house. And then later the tanner is walking along, and some outcasts of some other, from some other occupation see him and say, how come you are headed to the Brahmin's quarter? And he says, I need somebody for my daughter's engagement. And they say, that one? You know, he doesn't have, you know, compassion enough for, you know, to dip a needle into. But this, you know, this man goes there and the Brahmin sets him a bunch of work. The principal piece of work is to hack away at a large knot of wood. And the pundit says, you know, I haven't been able to do it, but you see what kind of shape I am in. And you can tell from the story that the pundit is about, you know, 8 times the girth of the poor tanner. So it's very hot. He starts to work on the wood. He needs a break. He comes to the house where he's been before, and he wants a little coal to light his tobacco with. You know, he'll smoke a little and then go back to the knot of wood. And so he goes up to the door frame of the kitchen and says, Mrs. Pandit, you know, Panditain, could I have some coal for my... And she's outraged that he would speak to her across the door frame. And she says, wait till I have some coals or something, and then... She picks some coal with tongs and flings it at him, and some of it falls on his arm or leg, and he jumps back and he apologizes profusely. So that's the kind of setting. And then you cut to the priest who's just come back from a ritual bath in the equivalent of the Ganga, and who's, you know, who's prayed before the deity and who's smeared ash on himself and is, you know, rubbing his belly. And then he looks out of his perspective on the tanner and says, you haven't made any headway yet, you know, that's barely an incision and whatever, and maybe that other tanner crosses at some stage and offers him a beedi, you know, another smoke. This, I could lead you through. The story is, it's very vivid. When in the afternoon he has still not split that log of wood, the pundit walks up to him and mocks his manliness and says, just a little more effort from, and I'll, you know, then we'll go on to your daughter. And the man swings like crazy, and, you know, one of those strokes, he himself falls down dead. And now the question is, how are they going to get the corpse away from the pundit's house out to the cremation ground, because all the tanners by now know that he was out there working for the pundit and he died. The man who gave him tobacco told other people, and he's also organized his group to say none of us is going to carry the corpse. So the moment of complexity for the pundit is he's got to figure out what to do with the corpse, and he's got to figure out, he's got to have some sense of who he might have been to allow this to happen. And this is very powerful. You know, his moment, it's not a real anagnorisis, but the hints and beginnings of it, while the man figures out finally that if he loops a piece of rope around the man's leg and drags him, if he lassos the leg and drags him, he won't touch it and be contaminated. And he can also haul the corpse to the cremation ground. And then the last sentence of the story is, you know, he lay where the hyenas and the vultures could get at him. This was his reward for a life of piety. And he was using the Sanskrit and scriptural term sadgati for those who find the afterlife, for those whose going has been virtuous. Gati is going and sad is true. So this man's sadgati was to be abandoned among vultures and jackals for trusting that the priest would. It's a very short story, and of course this is modern India. The constitution of India says we are all within, those who are within India are, have equal rights as citizens. He has stories about women, he has stories about landless workers, but this is his one story about the spiritual life. And without framing it for you, if you'll just let me read it, it won't, it's 5 or 7 minutes, and then we can talk. So in Hindi, the story is called Atma Sangeet. Atma, that word for self, or we can say loosely soul, and Sangeet is music. So soul music. And this is a translation just for us, meaning it's, as far as I know, it's not been translated. And when I began to think of what would be appropriate as a way of indicating how Hindus in India construe life, action, effort, I thought this would be a telling story. So this is, you're the first people to hear it translated by me, and I suspect the first people to have it translated into English at all. The time was midnight, the place the banks of a river. The stars in the sky were still, but their reflections shivered in the water. The strains of a heavenly life-giving melody hung over the darkness, as hope dwells in the heart or sorrow upon faces. The strains of a heavenly life-giving melody hung over the darkness, as hope dwells in the heart or sorrow upon faces. Her name, Queen Manorama. Queen Manorama had received initiation from her guru that day. She had fasted during daylight hours and distributed alms to countless beggars. She slept soundly now, the sweet sleep of a day well spent, when the melody reached into her sleep. She grew agitated as moths drawn to a flame flutter their wings, as ants sensing the presence of sugar begin to scurry. She threw on a gown and stole out quietly past guards and doorkeepers. Thorn bushes grew thick along the riverbank, sheltering strange animals and their piercing cries. Corpses burned in the cremation ground, more frightening for the images they stirred in the mind. Manorama was the ideal of softness and grace. Nothing could have led her to this wild terrain except the music. She followed the sound without giving a thought to the dangers which might beset her. She walked on till the river blocked her progress. Break. I had meant to read you earlier a Kabir poem from the selection last time as a context, and you will forgive me. But the Kabir poem was, to what shore would you cross, O my heart? There is no traveler before you. There is no road. Where is the movement? Where is the rest on that shore? There is no water, no boat, no boatman is there. There is not so much as a rope to tow the boat, nor a man to draw it. No earth, no sky, no time, no thing is there, no shore, no ford. I'm breaking off, but that's the part we need to know. And another bit of cultural background, that samsara, or this place of becoming and altering, is often seen as one shore of existence. We cross over to the other side, and then we are with being. This is a popular figure for emergence into true being. And often yogis and sadhus and swamis and mahatmas help ferry us across, help us become ourselves. So she walked on till the river blocked her progress. Manorama looked around desperately. She saw a boat moored among the shadows and made her way to the boatman sitting in it. "Boatman, ferry me across. I must follow the music which floats over from the other side." The boatman said he did not row his boat across the river at night. The winds are strong and the waves disturbed. There is danger to life and limb. "But I am queen," Manorama said. "Untie the boat. I will pay you whatever you ask for." "Queens don't fare well on the river. There is no question of my taking you across." "I beseech you, boatman, undo the rope. I am helpless. The music has seized my soul." "What's my reward?" "Whatever you ask for." "Tell me what people should seek from queens. I am a peasant and may ask for something inappropriate." "Take my necklace for your fare. It's priceless." As she undid the fastener, the jewels gleamed and shone upon the boatman's features. He had an old face scored with lines. At that very moment, the music drew nearer. It seemed to Manorama that a person, a Gyani Purush, that a person who understood creation, poured out his understanding in song, filling the quiet of the night with the soul's joy. "Boatman," Manorama pleaded, "I can't wait another instant. Be quick with freeing the boat and setting out." "What good is the necklace to me?" the boatman asked. "They are real pearls," the queen said. "If my wife wears pearls, her neighbors will burn with envy. They will gossip about her behind her back. A thief may see her with the necklace and plot to steal it. He might break into our lonely hut looking for more treasure. Other villagers will accuse me of theft. I can't take the necklace. It will bring me harm." "Choose something else, but don't delay. I can't endure more waiting. The music is agony." "Make a better offer." "You are cruel," the queen said, "trapping me in words while the night flies. You refuse what I propose without saying what it is you want. If only you knew my condition, I could give you anything for passage across the river." "Offer me something better." "The necklace is the most precious thing I have on, but I promise you, if you untie the boat, I will deed you my palace of white marble. There is none like it in all of India." The boatman laughed. "What would I do with a palace? I will have no happiness there, far away from my brothers and neighbors, huddled in a lonely corner of a huge building. On my boat, I know no fear, even on moonless nights, even when a storm blows hard. How will I find companions in that vast building? How will I maintain it? Where will I find servants and gardeners? Roses and gardenias will go dry. Pigeons will make nests in the balconies. Jackals will howl from the shrubbery." Manorama felt sudden access of joy. The music had come closer. Its beauty was brighter as a lamp grows bright when the wick is turned up. She sighed with longing. "Why do you not tell me what you seek? The raga of detachment pulls me away from the world. I long for that heavenly music as water longs for low places, as the lungs long for air, as perfume longs for the sky. The music has in it the ecstasy of the koel bird, the anguish of the papiha bird, the torrential force of waterfalls. Its sound awakens discrimination, purges the inner mind, permeates the soul. An instant more of waiting is death. Undo the ropes. Take me across to the flower whose perfume I smell, to the flame whose light drenches me. I cannot bear to be away from the maker of the music. He is so near." The boatman declared that the palace was of no use to him. His hut was more pleasing than any palace. "What can I offer you? What I hear is not mere music. It is the beauty of space, the perfume of constellations, the source of sweetness, the essence of all conditions of being. Undo the rope. I promise to serve you as long as I live. I shall fetch water for you. I shall sweep. I shall clear pebbles from the path. I shall bring flowers for your hut. I shall massage your wife's feet. Dear boatman, if I had 100 lives, I would sacrifice them for the music. I have reached the limit of my capacity to endure. I burn. I beg you, do not disappoint me any longer. Like a defeated person, Manorama ran to the boatman and fell at his feet. The music drew nearer, bathing her in its radiance. She began to dance. It seemed to her she was flying through the air and the stars glowed behind in their stations. She forgot herself. Now the giddy music flowed through her, the notes of the raga formed in her own throat. Indescribable sweetness poured forth from her lips. She was herself the source of the music she had once heard floating from the other side. Her face had become bright like the moon. The light of love shone from her eyes. And this from a person who was fundamentally an activist writer. That's the end of my presentation. It's a good story. Huh? Somebody who writes about social issues to reform particular injustices, he was especially, as I was saying, so activist in the sense of seeking to act on behalf of social justice locally. You know, and a mystical writer would act on behalf of social justice more recessively, entirely, by harmonizing the person and trusting that all action emerging from a harmonized person would be good. So this is just frame of reference. I'm not interested in conversation unless you are, because stories are other spaces. Good, I'm happy to conclude. And we can return to conversation another time. But for him to lead her till she becomes herself the source of music. Lovely question. And I mean, when we look at it from a distance, you know, she has been initiated by her guru that day. Was she initiated in music? And how come the guru doesn't figure? You know, she's... just a formal ritual entry into the meditative practices of... Yeah. But, for instance, if a guru of music takes me on as a disciple, there would be a ceremony, and when the guru felt that I had discovered my nature in their discipline, then the guru would release me and there would be a ritual. And so initiation is the acceptance into. But it happens in, and you know, all this, the boatman with whom she has to plead. And I'm not a great believer in explanations. I hear about Stravinsky that he played some music once and he was asked to explain what he had played. And he said, "You didn't understand what I played?" And people said no, or somebody said no. He said, "I'll play it for you again." I'm of that philosophy. In the original.
Okay, so last night, as many people as could fit into my car, went to the 1 year, it's called the Hilula. Hilula is literally a wedding celebration. So the underlying understanding is that when a master passes on in the world to come, It's a time of wedding. It's the spiritual wedding for him up in heaven. And therefore, the annual hilulah for the soul of a master or a tzaddik or someone passes away is always considered a great event in Hasidic mystical circles. So this was the first hilulah, which means commemorating 1 year since the departure of Rabbi Shalom Noach Barzovsky, who was the head of the Slonim Hasidim in Israel. Slonim is a town in Lithuania, so this is a group of Lithuanian Hasidim. This man has published a very systematic kind of encyclopedic introduction to Hasidism for this generation. Jason spent time with me this year. We spent a semester going through that work before we turned our attention to another work. It's called Netivot Shalom, and it exists in two volumes on, well, one volume is General Avodat Hashem, Service of God, one volume on Shabbat and Chagim, and five volumes on the Torah, and then there's additional various other tractates. He's a very clear, systematic, perceptive thinker. And his son, Rabbi Shmuel Barzovsky, is present Rebbe. And as I was listening to him, I said, whoa, this is just so much along the lines of what we're working on. I want you to hear what a contemporary eulogy for someone who passed away a year ago delivered last night in Mea Shearim, how it conceptualizes a holy man. And then about 10 minutes into the thing, I took out my paper and started to take down notes so I could translate it for you from the Yiddish. So I don't remember exactly all the ideas, but this I will look now at my notes and try and recreate it. So he began by making reference to the fact. First of all, we have to maybe some pictures about the context. Okay. A man in his early 60s, white hair. He didn't have furhat. Everybody sits at the head of a long table. Oh, maybe it seats 50 people on each side of it. Two big candles. Set up like for a Shabbat in a synagogue, with all sides of him tables, and then people standing, and then finally people standing on bleachers going up to a mezzanine floor. All in all, I would say under 1,000 people in the room. Okay, but something of close to 1,000 people. Yes, Jason.
I was thinking maybe 700.
Okay, so the range is between 700 and 1,000 people. We didn't count them. I estimate more like 1,000. Jason estimates more like 700. All men. All in black, okay, except for us. And there is a women's gallery where there were women. Tell us how many women were there? It was full. How many men, women? 700? 300?
No,
not so much. 200? 100? One. Okay, so we're talking altogether about 1,000 people in there, an entire community, all coming together to remember. And children. You don't go anywhere without children. I pointed out to Sydney that the man next to me was constantly crying. He's a man I know for, big, chubby guy. I know him for about 24 years now. You know, and as they were sitting there was a long wait between the evening prayer and when the tish began, so we had some time to reminisce. You remember this, you remember that. People came up to me, very interesting. You know, they would come up to me as though suddenly I'm someone to tell. Do you have stories? This quest for story, because the life of a holy person is captured through a story. And total strangers, people who weren't even locals, but they may have been hanging around there for a long time. They may have got a connection with this group. So one guy kind of, did you ever go to him privately? Yes. Can you tell me a story? I said, yeah, I told him to tell you a story. You know, when I wanted to get married, I wanted him to do the wedding. He refused. You know, it's a story. All right, whatever. The story has more to it. But and then a second person asked, so do you have any story? Why did he refuse? I think you'll have to ask him that. But his son was there, the present Rebbe, he was there. And a second person came to me, and the man next to me, sort of the big guy, I look as, you know, the ritual, the thing was after the Rebbe came in, they started with three Hasidic nigunim, slow, meditative, people were very surprised when I played the same songs again on the CD in my car, that was the same song, because suddenly the song that had a melody, it was no longer recognizable as being melodic, because this is their particular melodical style. I think it's about 15. And look, at the guy's got, he's got tears in his eyes the whole time, he's crying. So obviously he was crying, and I asked him, it's hard for you. He said, well, you know how much you meant to us. So this is really a time that people are being very moved by the memory of someone. It's not a tish of people getting up and singing and dancing, right? It was very... Okay, and then the context of that, after three songs, and with people feeling as I've more or less described, here's the reference. So he's speaking about the fact that, and he delivers this with an intonation. Okay, he doesn't give a lecture, but it's delivered in Yiddish, and it's delivered in a particular intonation. There's a sing song that goes with it. Okay, so it's not just said; it's almost chanted. I couldn't see his eyes. Sidney, maybe you saw him. It was with closed eyes as he was delivering this, or with open eyes? Usually with closed eyes.
Well, I didn't see him the whole time he was talking, but the time that I did see him, his eyes were closed.
Yeah, most of the time his eyes would be closed, because he's sort of in a prayerful meditative. Did you see Thomas? Eyes closed when he spoke?
Yeah.
Yeah, eyes closed, okay. So, what I remember, there may have been a few points before, he was talking about the importance of... See, this Rebbe came from Europe, where the entire community virtually perished, and he basically revived the community here. Because basically Hasidic communities existed in Eastern Europe, and those that made it are the ones that were able to transplant themselves from Europe to Israel. And only those that managed to find some surviving person to get the thing going again survived. And he, even though he wasn't Rebbe at the time, he was son-in-law of someone who he helped crown as Rebbe and got the thing going while he himself served as their prime number one educator, being the head of the yeshiva, in turn later to become Rebbe. So he's talking about the fact of how, Sam was talking about how this man, first of all, he was basically the one who saved the entire community, because there was just, you know, embers living after the Holocaust, and he put the community together. Referred to the fact that he was irreplaceable, how could anybody replace him? He started to talk about the book, and what a profound book it is, how influential it is, how universal it is in its appeal, how people from all walks of life, rich and poor, Ashkenazi and Sephardi, in Israel and abroad, in all ranges of societies are always finding something in this particular book. And he took quite a bit of time to discuss the power of the man as encapsulated in the book. And then he created acronym?
Yeah. Give me a thing of me.
Okay, his name is Shalom Noah. Well, if the name is really Berezovsky, but they pronounce it as Barazovsky, usually Barazovsky. The Lutheran Hasidim, the present rabbi is Samuel. Berezovsky, his son, Berezovsky, which very often is pronounced Barzovsky. Okay, and then he gave the following notarikon, Tzemach. Okay, now, what did we say notarikon was? Acronym. Now, acronym means you take the first letter and you create the three. You take a word, three words, and you create sort of a each letter signaling sign. Now, Tzemach is a term that is used biblically towards the Messiah. I don't think there was an acronym. Because they're about to spell out three words that I'm about to relate to. No. He just chose that. He used that as a pedagogical device, as he built his thing. Now, Tzemach also has messianic allusions. I don't know how consciously or not he was... Tzemach literally is plant, and the seed of Jesse is referred to in messianic terms as Tzemach. So there's this potential of a plant, a growth. And he takes this Tzemach, and he creates from it the following acronym. Tzadi stands for Tzadik. You know that word, right? It was on his blackboard just a couple of days ago. The Chet stands for, well, come on, just to show that Barry was not 100% right in my choice of terms, what does the Chet stand for? Chesed would be one word. What's the other word? No, the word that I used, Chacham, okay, Chacham. And the Mem stands for Manhig being leader, okay? So basically, he decides to eulogize his father with three terms that we've employed in one way or another.
thereby not so much proving Bayer's point, disproving Bayer's point, but proving the point that not the Pharisee, but proving what you said, which was the difference between the imic and the etic, or the insider and the outsider's view, and therefore how from the inside you try to capture certain terms and the relevance of these terms for people conceptualizing from inside the tradition. Okay, so the usefulness. You see that he chose these three terms, and then he continued. So then he started to go through these three. tzaddik. And he started, first of all, to spell out in what way this man was a tzaddik. So he started by talking about what a powerful servant of God he was from his youth, okay? How he was, as tzaddik, totally open and receiving for everyone. His moral qualities, his patience. He never had a fight to pick with anyone. Nobody ever saw him getting angry or contentious. That there was a nobility and gentleness in his manners, and I can testify to that. He really was a very gentle and refined man. Something I said to Sydney last night: you go to some of the other Hasidus, they push you, right? If you're in there, so you go to Slonim, you stand in someone's place, he offers you a cup of tea, and you know, this is, someone said that, and I think it's true. And this is really an indication of something that he installed in his students. Then he went on to talk about the power of prayer and the centrality of prayer in his life, and also about the fact that in his works that were found after his death, they found the technical term is hasagas. Hasagas is spiritual insights, spiritual illuminations. He said that people didn't know that he had, suggesting that he had a much deeper mystical life than found expression in the works, okay? Suggesting he had hasagas. And he said, we can't even publish them because they're so radical. But he said we were just struck by the hasagas that we found just in his writing. Then he went on to talk about manhig, leader, okay? And he began, very interesting, with the analogy to Moses, okay? So he said, he is like Moses. The distinction being that normally there's an upward movement, but the case of Moses is the leader who comes and descends towards the people. And he cited explicitly that Moses is the one who descends towards the people. And what's the purpose for which he descends? The purpose is that he is there in order to raise the others. So he characterized him as a leader, as someone who makes the descent in order to enable others to ascend. And that basically his whole purpose in being a leader was in order to elevate the people around him. And then he spoke about the fact that he was speaking, one thing I forgot to say, this goes back to something that Barry mentioned. When he spoke to him about his saga, someone who had spiritual attainments, he said, like the earlier generations. When the point Barry made, not so much today, but I think yesterday, when you objected to my own typology, or was that there was sort of a downward sense of decline in time where the earlier generations were the greater ones. And maybe that also influenced his claim, his suggestion today, that foundation figures can't even qualify as saints, as though they were somehow beyond that whole thing. Well, it was interesting to think of the Rebbe's greatness and his spiritual attainments by analogy of the fact that he doesn't belong to this generation. Okay, so he had the spiritual, mystical insight that classified him as someone who belonged to a former generation. And then speaking about what it meant to be a sage. 82. Son 60, yeah, 82. I think 82, 83. I think 82. Then he speaks about his wisdom, and he begins by quoting the Talmud, where the Talmud talks about the fact that a sage is preferable to a prophet. Okay, part of the rabbinic coming to terms with the change of role between, when we spoke about the biblical metaphor of prophet, the biblical religious type of the prophet and the rabbinic one of the sage, the sages have to come to terms with the fact that they've declared prophecy to no longer exist. One of the ways they do is by affirming the fact that a sage is greater than a prophet. So he applied that. He says, what is his wisdom? The ability to understand a situation. Okay? And not only to understand individual situations, but understand the generational situation, to have an understanding of what it is that the generation needs, what its problems are.
and that he could see to the depth of the need of this generation, and sometimes in a far-sighted way that others couldn't even see, and then he went on to say that others next to him in this context were like children. And then he cited the verse that we'd read 2 weeks ago, where Moses tells Pinchas, elevate the head of all those who go into the battle. And he says, well, this is what he did. We're all the warriors, we're all the soldiers, we're going into the battle. And it was up to him to elevate our heads. Nasarat Rosh Anshei Milchama. He raises us to a higher degree. Because unless he does the job of raising us, we cannot ascend. And what he said was that through meeting him, people were transformed. Okay, he said literally, you become another person through his power. And not through what he's... But through the very encounter with him, that turns you into another man. This goes back to what I said today during the panel about the power of the holy man, right? Being so much more than moral example. So this is precisely what he was saying, that the transformative power of the encounter with the holy man. He says, and he brings with him a spirit of purity. Okay, whoever is in his presence feels the spirit of purity. And how many stories can we tell from other traditions? You stand next to the master, you feel the power of purity flowing from him. And anyone, he said, can think, where would I be today were it not for him? And in fact, we have to be thankful. Because in fact, each one of us owes us his life, implying his spiritual life. And he founded a community almost out of nothing. So it's not only his own personal power, it's a community building power. Quoting Isaiah, Ubanu mechorvot olam osdei dor vador. The ruins of eternal ruins will be built from you, the foundations from generation to generation. And when he left, our world was darkened. Who on earth could fill his place? Who could lead the generation? Who says this? The leader. The person who's now replaced him is saying, who can replace him? He's not saying, I'm replacing him. He's saying, who can replace him? He's irreplaceable. But he said, we had the merit. And here he cites a Talmudic notion of placing a yeshiva on someone's tomb. It means to say, historically, in context, bringing sages to learn at the tomb of someone as a memorial for him. He reads this expression to mean that the entire yeshiva is based upon this man's tomb, meaning that his spirit continues to be with us. Since the spirit, now this is a whole other idea we haven't yet discussed, but we touched on it again today briefly in the panel, since why do you go to the tombs of tzaddikim? Because the understanding is that their spirit remains in the tomb. Well, if their spirit is in the tomb, we found a yeshiva upon this tomb. What that means is basically we continue to be connected to his spirit, and his spirit continues to be with us. And therefore, it's in fact what he's saying is that he wanted his spirit to continue in the form of the yeshiva, and therefore we've never really left him. And we have... supernatural, he expressed himself that way, lemala min hateva. He says, there's a supernatural gift that we received, but we continue to feel ourselves connected to him. We continue to feel his spirit still hovering amidst us. So what he's really saying is that I'm not the leader. You may be giving me all the homage, but in fact the one who's really directing is still my father. Exact same strategy with the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, who throughout his entire period always referred to his deceased father-in-law as the Rebbe, the master or the nasi, the prince of our generation. Okay, he always kept reverting it back as though he's basically just an agent of the previous generation. A very very interesting and similar move. And he said, and then he quoted the deceased master saying, before his death, God is not going to leave us. Okay, thereby suggesting that he in some way was involved in this process of continuity. And therefore he was, and this goes back to something Sidney was saying today, he said that his late father, he was the shaliach shel tzaddikim. Shaliach, he was the intermediary, the representative of tzaddikim, means of the great, of the saints, in the sense of communion of the saints, right? In the sense of, there's a world of tzaddikim up there, okay? The Baal Shem Tov, the Magid of Mezrich, the whole tradition of great spiritual masters. He was their shaliach, he was their representative while he was alive. Okay, so even then he wasn't working on his own power. He was working on a power that was far beyond him that he was mediating. And even now, he continues to be an agent for those saints. And thereby comes forth the spirit of union amidst us. So he was emphasizing the fact that sometimes it happens that someone dies and the followers split into two because they can't agree who to go with. And no,
He says, no, we're remaining united, because the reason we've been able to remain united this year was because his spirit was with us. No, the previous generation, not this generation. Not, they did not split after his death. No, there was no, that was previous, you know, 20 years ago they split. And then he quotes the verse from Kohelet. I praise the dead from those who are alive, for they are still alive. Normally, how does the verse read? That he praises the dead from those who, live people who are still alive. He, this goes back to what Barry was saying about the ambiguity in the biblical text and our ability to read it differently, which opens up the gates of exegesis. So he reads it, I praise those dead who are still alive more than those who are alive, thereby suggesting that there's a category of dead who are still alive. Who are the dead who are still alive? Well, the Talmud says that the righteous, that tzaddikim, are greater in the death more than they are in their life. So basically, this kind of a master who, when he's dead, continues to operate and to inspire and to give to his community, is the kind of dead who is still alive. Okay? And then he continued to cite another text, which is really the locus classicus of the theology of saints, and that is that saints are greater in their death more than they are in their life. This is a statement found in the Talmud, "Gedolim tzadikim b'mitatam yoter b'chayehim," and the recognition of the greatness of the saints after their death is the foundation stone of all the veneration of saints and the approach to the saints after their death, because in fact the understanding is that without the limitation of the body, they can do more rather than do less. And then he goes on to say a very beautiful exegesis on the words of Abigail to David in 1 Samuel. The soul of my master shall be, help me, someone, bound up in the bundle of life. So he says, through the fact that you connect yourself with his holy words and you want to get close to God through them, they become for you a source of life. Let me see that I understand what I just wrote. Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't read my reading. Okay. Alideshe Talmidim. Through the fact that disciples connect themselves to the Master and want through him to come close to God, they become a source of life. So, Tzura Bitzro Chayim, the soul of the Master becomes Nefesh Adonit, Tzura Bitzro Chayim. Through our approach to them, that continues to empower them to be a source of life, transferring life to us, even where they are now, after death. And therefore, the verse that we read in the Torah that we will, with regard to the physical land of Israel, that we will ascend to it and inherit it, he says, Alon Ale Ve'Arashnuta, that refers not to the physical land, but to the spiritual land, to the Olam Ha'elyon. And he therefore finishes that he should be praying in the same way that when he was alive, he prayed for redemption and compassion to the individual and to the totality of everyone. We pray that he continues to be their source of drawing salvation, physically and spiritual, which means with the physical needs that the Master provides for his disciples, children, food, well-being, whatever, and spiritually as well. Now, basically what you have in this sermon, okay, is the entire Hasidic teaching on the meaning of what a tzaddik is encapsulated in one eulogy. Because it shows the power of the devotion, the sincerity, the feeling. It shows the theology of where the tzaddikim stand in relationship to God. It shows you something additional that's very important, which is that you don't just say the ideas. There's a way of saying them. You're saying them by putting them into literary forms, creating a kind of wordplay, constantly bringing biblical texts and interpreting them, right? So he cites this verse from, we will ascend it, we will conquer it, in reference to the world to come. He raises the head of the people who go to war. He praises the living dead and those who are still, and all those things throughout. There's an entire series. Biblical interpretation is an inseparable part of this kind of a eulogy. He's not only saying what a wonderful man he was. He's saying what he did historically to the community, what he did to people individually, where he was in relationship to God, but throughout there's a hermeneutical process going. And there's a mixture here of biblical interpretation, reflection on a person, and prayer, all happening simultaneously in one literary form that merges together. And it wouldn't have made much difference for most of you to have been there because he delivered it in Yiddish, but when we just look at the unfolding of this particular text, we really see encapsulated in it a very, very living sense of what saint means to people here and now today.